Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 8th of January. We have a lot to talk about this hour of the program. We are going to, for a good portion of the program, talk about the U.S. military role in Afghanistan, which officially ended December 28 with a ceremony in Kabul. This after 13 years of combat operations, but over 10,000 troops remain. Their role to assist the country's military and police forces with counterterrorism and training. We'll ask our guest, what have we achieved after 13 years? But also the terrorist attack on the newspaper Charlie Hebdo yesterday, leaving 12 people dead, among the deadliest attacks in post-war France, has been an issue that we wanted to be sure and address today, and our guest can give a response to that as well. The New York Times today said that it appears that this was done by homegrown Muslim extremists. We don't really know that yet, but we'll find out more should they be captured. But we'll ask our guest, because he is an expert in international terrorism as well. Actually, he says most of his interviews and speeches these days focus on ISIS and other al-Qaeda-related franchises that subscribe to the al-Qaeda narrative. Did he see an al-Qaeda narrative in this horrendous act of terror yesterday? It's been a while since we have spoken with Thomas Goodyear. He is the Dean of International Studies and Programs, the Senior Officer for Global Engagement, and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He lived and worked for almost 10 years in Afghanistan. Between 65 and 74, he was a Peace Corps volunteer, a Fulbright Fellow, and Executive Director of the Fulbright Foundation. And he also coached the Afghan National Basketball Team. He was later Senior Political Affairs Officer on the UN special mission to Afghanistan. In 96, he has testified on various topics related to that country, U.S.-Pakistani relations, international terrorism, and human rights. He has testified before the Senate and before the House. He speaks, reads, and writes Afghan Persian, Iranian Persian, Tajikistani Persian, knows many other languages, and the Center for Afghanistan Studies has done so much to deliver education to hundreds, tens of thousands of Afghan children in refugee camps in Pakistan and at many sites in war-torn Afghanistan. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Thomas Goodyear, thank you so much for being with us again. Good afternoon.
Great to be back with you again, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. Let's start with what's certainly getting a lot of attention today, and that's yesterday's terrorist attack on Charlie Hebdo in Paris, a horrendous act of terror. And it's interesting to see the world response to this, the number of people who are posting on Facebook, the number of demonstrations, solidarity that have taken place in Europe and also in the United States. What do you think of this attack? And would you go as far as the Times did today in saying it was probably the work of homegrown Muslim extremists?
Well, it appears that way. And, of course, I have no way of really specifically knowing that until they absolutely capture that those two individuals that they're still searching for. But it's so familiar to me in terms of what you mentioned earlier, in that there is this al-Qaeda narrative to which many individuals subscribe, even if they don't belong to an official al-Qaeda-related franchise, of which there are many, many around the world, and who, for one reason or other, they're either disaffected from their own community, their families, and subscribe to this and act accordingly, or they go abroad and join organizations like ISIS or other al-Qaeda related terrorist related organizations. So we've seen other examples of the same kind of what people might refer to as homegrown activities or threats of same, particularly in the United Kingdom, and we've had potential such threats here in the United States, and we've seen individuals who have left the Twin City area, for example, or from Colorado to try and join up with ISIS in Syria. So there is this attraction, and each time it gets in the news, it brings attention to it, and more people go to it, and they tune into the narrative. And if they are among these individuals who are disaffected, then they might be very susceptible for recruitment.
And when you say the Al-Qaeda narrative, Professor Goodyear, what is that narrative?
Well, it's presented in various ways, but in a sense, it boils down to the fact that there are several main enemies to Islam and the way they believe it should be practiced. And, of course, the Al-Qaeda interpretation or presentation of Islam is not Islam. It's a very perverted, bastardized form which serves groups or individuals' own political or social agendas. But it focuses on a number of enemies that they believe hurt the Muslim community, or at least the one that they understand to be. The number one enemy, you have to remember, amongst Al-Qaeda members is Shia Islam. And that's why this complication in ISIS is made all the more complicated, because of the civil war in Syria and the civil war in Iraq, which is, civil war because of sectarian religious differences. The other enemies are the corrupting forces of westernization, also Muslim states, governments, which they do not believe are truly Islamic. So they're not feel favorable towards the monarchies of the Middle East that are Arab and Muslim. So this is the basic narrative. In other words, they try and play upon people as being victimized, the religion being victimized, and saying that there is this crusade which they have to keep their religion pure and away from these corrupting forces.
And the kinds of terrorism that we have seen, this was a very large attack, but we, of course, saw an attack in Canada. We've seen a small number of people, or sometimes only one person, carrying out terror. Is that part of the Al-Qaeda narrative as well? And as Europe particularly tries to deal with these kinds of acts, which can appear in many places, and they're very worried, and understandably so worried about them, how do you counter them? How do you figure out where they may take place, and what do you do about it?
I don't know if that's the strategy, but what it is that's the danger. The danger that terrorism really only requires one individual. And we've seen that in our own country with the bombing of the Murrah building in Oklahoma City by, Timothy McVeigh. Mm-hmm. And so it only takes one individual. And if you'll recall, during that period, those several days, we didn't know who had done what, and it really discombobulated our national confidence. And so it only takes one individual. That's the real major danger of terrorism. It can be so random, and it doesn't require a large group of people. And but one person can kill many. And here we had two who killed, many. And we had the similar kind of thing that occurred in Boston with the marathon. You mentioned the situation in Canada as well. And there have been subway attacks in France and England, et cetera. This is the primary danger. You get people who subscribe to the narrative, and if they have the means, one or two individuals can really strike terror in the hearts of citizens and create a certain lack of confidence in one society if that society is unable to protect them.
Right. The editor of Charlie Hebdo, who was killed yesterday, had said that freedom of expression is nothing without the right to offend. And the magazine offended, evidently, Muslims, Jews, Christians, politicians, French cartoonists, and some journalists have a long, long history of doing that, as do many Western countries, many democracies throughout the world. How do you put together a society in which that is a stated goal of a democracy. The freedom of expression means that you can offend with a group of people, extreme as they may be, and maybe a smaller number, who believe that if you offend like that, the response is to kill.
Well, that's a very, very difficult question to answer, Kathleen, because obviously that requires national and local decisions. Oftentimes, we run the danger, perhaps, of overzealous pursuit to protect people. But at the same time, you've got to protect people. That's a responsibility for certainly the president. That's his first kind of major charge, to protect and defend. And so at the same time, you know, we hold dear these principles of freedom of expression. I agree with that on two points. One, from the strictly, real point of that, in which I believe in that, but also from the kind of the fun of it all, which we live in our society, in which we find out that more people between the ages of 20 and 35 get their news from The Daily Show and you know, the Colbert Report than they do from, you know, serious reporting. I mean, this is all a part of the fabric of a society, and I enjoy that humor, but I also strongly believe in the need for us to be able to have that ability to, you know, to puncture people's pride and their activities through satire like this. This is a major part of the element of our free press.
We want to give our audience a chance to respond to what happened yesterday, because it was so horrifying. So feel free to direct your comments to that. We're going to move on to a discussion of Afghanistan because our guest is also an Afghanistan expert and actually lived in the country. We love him for this for a number of years, coached the Afghan national basketball team. And it made some news, but was not a huge story, that there was an official ending of the U.S. military role, although with the number of troops we're leaving behind, it doesn't quite seem as though it is ending. But it's been 13 years, and we immediately thought of Thomas to respond to that news and to ask him, let me ask, what we have accomplished in 13 years, Professor Goodyear.
Well, I think a lot has been accomplished, and we don't quickly see the accomplishments in the news, because the news generally responds to dramatic events, and generally those are unfortunate events where people are killed or attacked. And so that's what most people see, the overlay of the news. But under that veneer, in some ways, there's a lot of things that have happened. Afghanistan today, from the Afghanistan of 2001 before 9/11, has been changed dramatically. As one who lived there during what was considered the golden era of Afghanistan, the 64-74 period during the monarchy, it's not yet there, because at that time there was high security. There was absolutely no problem going anywhere in Afghanistan individually and ever fearing for any person's harm. My wife, who was a Peace Corps volunteer with me, 5'1", 110 pounds then, and now she would appreciate me saying, she could hop on her bicycle any time of the day and go into the deep bazaars without any concern. And later on, we had our first child born to us there, and she would take that child into the bazaars. Again, no issues. And of course, that was all dramatically changed when the Soviet Union invaded and occupied the country and totally tore it apart. And then the Afghans have been trying with other help, which has been not very consistent. It's been sporadic, as you know. We kind of dumped the Afghans in 89 when the Soviets left, and then 9/11 brought us back there. But it really came apart, civil wars and nothing in terms of a future projected for Afghanistan. And in we came, and we drove out the al-Qaeda elements with Taliban and the Pakistani military. It must be stated that the Pakistani military was a part of that, and the drug lords, etc. And so now Afghanistan today is not a training ground for elements of terrorists, but those are being trained across the border still in Pakistan, or in places like Syria now and northern Iraq or Somalia or northern Nigeria and the Sahara lands, training programs there. But also, here's something as a journalist you will be appreciate, Kathleen. There are more than 80 independent private television stations in Afghanistan.
Are there? Oh.
I mean, think about it. That's more than England or France or Germany have. And how is this about? It doesn't speak to the quality, but then we have many channels in the cable or satellite networks as well, which may not be of really high quality. What it means, of course, is that people have 80 choices, and they're still functioning. They'll probably winnow out just because of the economics of it all, but there are 30 radio stations of that nature, and maybe as many as 1,000. Pieces of print information, magazines, news, etc. There are more women, more girls going to school today in Afghanistan than in its history. Of course, there are more people in Afghanistan. So, but the percentages of females and boys going to school are higher than at any time in its history. They've gone through a constitutional period here. They've passed a constitution based on the one from 1964. Under which I lived during that golden era, but almost exactly like that, except it transformed Afghanistan from a monarchy to a republic. And they've gone through 3 presidential elections, not totally perfect elections, but then we had Florida in 2000, et cetera. It's not easy to build a nation and a constitution, but they've gone through these things. I think people are committed, particularly young people. They're committed to a future without the overlay of the warlords from the past who fought the Soviets and their extreme religious sectarian politics of those individuals and others. They want a future. And if you went to Afghanistan, you would be surprised, amazed to see the dynamism. There's still the dangers, but the dynamism, the commitment, it's there. It's visible. The future depends on 2 main things, whether it's friends, the United States, NATO, the international community will continue to be supportive, and whether or not the 20-ton gorilla in the room, Pakistan, really reins in those terrorist elements which seek and gain refugees in Pakistan, gain resources, and are trained there. Those are the terrorists who are in Afghanistan. Without those, Afghans could handle their security issues without many problems.
Does it seem reasonable to you, Thomas, that 10,800 U.S. troops remain? And if so, what should they be doing now?
Yes, I think that's most reasonable. And I think one of the reasons why, as you indicated when you introduced the topic, that it was without a lot of fanfare. I think if we were totally out, it would have been more fanfare, like when we totally got out of Iraq. I think what that representation is, of that 10,000-plus number, is that we're still understanding that our interests in that region, as well as our interests globally and domestically, are dependent upon whatever type of stability we can bring to the one country in that region that whose citizens are really very, very pro-United States. And I can tell you with great confidence that more than 90% of the Afghan population would fear our exit. And think of the women who've gone from what they had to endure under the Taliban to today, where they are actively engaged now in their society, where 29% of the representatives in the lower house of the Afghan parliament are female, guaranteed by that constitution. You think of that, and you think of their fear that if we're not there to help kind of support them as they move forward, you understand that. It's very similar to the type of impact that NATO's presence in Europe after the Second World War was able to help the Europeans move from their post-war reconstruction through that period to where they've developed this European Union. And Afghanistan needs, help and interest from people outside their country as they are rebuilding their Humpty Dumpty, which was totally torn apart by that Soviet aggression.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Thomas Goodyear. He's Dean of International Studies and Programs, Senior Officer for Global Engagement, and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He has a keen understanding of the country because he lived there for a long period of time. He was a Peace Corps volunteer in the early years of the Peace Corps program. He was a Fulbright Fellow. Coached the Afghan national basketball team, later a senior political affairs official on the UN special mission to Afghanistan, has testified on many, many topics related to this country, to U.S.-Pakistani relations, international terrorism, and human rights before the Senate and also before the House. We originally, when we set this up last week, wanted to mark the December 28 announcement that the U.S. military role in Afghanistan was officially ended. And then yesterday, the terrorist attack took place in France on the newspaper Charlie Hebdo. And of course, Thomas, with his familiarity with terrorism and ISIS and al-Qaeda, we asked him to comment on that. And you're welcome to comment on that as well as we carry on. So here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. How do we counter what would appear to be homegrown terrorists? How do we fight an opponent like ISIS? We will ask Thomas about that. And do you think that the last 13 years of our involvement in Afghanistan have produced any kinds of successes? What do you think about leaving 10,800 troops behind? Do they need to be there? We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, and we start with Don in Stoughton. Hi, Don.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, before we were occupying Afghanistan, had to use Pakistan as an ally to have some occupation in the region. I was just wondering if now that it looks like we're going to be in Afghanistan for a long period of time, if our dependence on Pakistan has lessened at all.
Well, that's a very good question, by the way, and I think it recognizes the question itself, the integral nature of both Pakistan and Afghanistan to that Central Asian, South Asian region. And to a certain degree, if we have good relations with both of those two countries, and while we may have relations with each of the two, they don't necessarily have great relationships right now between them, the two of them. And so we're, I think, more able to at least by being acceptable to each of the two, to go between the two and try and see if there isn't some way to reduce the friction which exists there. And it has to do with age-old questions, borders and sectarian issues related to tribes, etc. But the major reason of the difference is Pakistan's paranoia of India and its commitment total to utilize whatever it can, and in this case, Afghanistan, instability in Afghanistan to ensure that its western borders are not in any way hostile like its eastern borders might be with India. I think the friendship with Afghanistan doesn't reduce our need to be active with Pakistan. The reason we have problems today with Pakistan is that our friendship with Pakistan in the past has been very fickle. We have gone from good friends to poor friends to back to good friends and then back to poor friends and good friends, whatever. And this has all, of course, been dependent upon whoever is leading our government's foreign policy and how he has interpreted our interests in the region. There isn't a consistency, continuity in terms of our policy. And as a result, we're not seen as very trustworthy, and that's the unfortunate situation. So we've constantly had to try and repair that relationship with Pakistan. But it's important for us to remain engaged with Pakistan, just as it is important for us to remain engaged with Afghanistan. America's interests in that part of the world are very, very dependent upon how stable that region, like any other region in the world, is. Our role as a global power or as a global economic power is dependent upon accessibility. And if we don't have that due to, you know, rampant instability everywhere, we're not going to be able to enjoy the lives that we are grown accustomed to in our own nation.
Tell me a little bit more. Thanks, Don, for your call about the Taliban, what they're up to these days, what kinds of negotiations are taking place between the Afghan government and the Taliban.
Well, I think the Taliban, as we know them, particularly as a word, have become kind of a more amorphous entity. In other words, at one time there was one Taliban group, and they were only in Afghanistan. They were led by Mullah Muhammad Omar. But then after 9/11, the Taliban elements of Afghanistan started to break apart, dependent primarily upon regional location and the way the Pakistanis dealt with them. So, for example, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar in the north has been often referred to as part of this Taliban insurgency, although he was never a part, really, of the Taliban. And then there's also the Haqqani network in between the northern group of Hikmatyar and the southern area, the Quetta Shura, led by Mullah Muhammad Omar, in and around the southern parts of Pakistan, Afghanistan. So you have these three groups. And there, within Afghanistan itself, there are many, many different regional elements that are in some ways insurgent or at least carrying arms and making their case known through arms, who aren't necessarily affiliated with any of these three Taliban elements or with al-Qaeda. And so it's important to understand the diversity of that. At the same time, then we have the Taliban elements of Pakistan, which at one time also were kind of organized, one Taliban group. They were responsible for Benazir Bhutto's death, for the bombings of the hotels in India and Islamabad, Pakistan, and other such crimes, attacking Malala Yousafzai and SWAT, etc. But they also are not as cohesive as they had been in the past, and they've started to break apart, and they're arguing amongst themselves because they're being threatened, and under those threats they're reacting for their own kind of interest and future, which don't always they share with all of the other parts that make up the Taliban. So I think it's important for us to encourage the Pakistanis to go after the Pakistani Taliban, as they are more disorganized and having problems, and at the same time to persuade the Pakistanis to do the same thing to those elements that are still considered under this general label of Afghanistan's Taliban, because those are the elements, the Afghanistan Taliban, who have refuge still in Pakistan, who create the problems inside Afghanistan for the most part.
We go next to Jason in Menominee. Hi.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to turn off my radio. I have several points. I'm really concerned as a former Marine why we are still in Afghanistan. And I guess talking about this, perpetuating the 9/11 myth, the power vacuum that was created by us leading the Soviets militarily during the 8-year conflict with the Afghanis, the use of the term al-Qaeda, it was never used before 9/11. From my research, it was created by Western intelligence agencies. Excessive terrorism talk in the media. I'm curious to know, as a Peace Corps volunteer, if he also had another mission there. I haven't heard any talk about the security for the ExxonMobil natural gas pipeline that's supposed to feed India and Pakistan. The opium production, from what I've read, it's gone up, not down, contrary to media sources, and why do several DEA agents go down in a chopper in Afghanistan?
All right, that's plenty on that agenda. Start with the opium issue, which hasn't received a lot of attention.
Yeah, it sure has. And by the way, that's a very, very full plate of
yes, it
different
is.
Issues. But
right.
The opium issues, you know, this is an important thing because of the impact that it has upon destabilizing the region and also destabilizing societies outside the region, like
sure.
our own and in Europe. And I can tell you this, that when I lived in Afghanistan from 64 to 74, I never once saw a field anywhere in that country under cultivation with opium poppies. All of that became possible during that time that after the Soviet invasion and occupation and the war that was then being carried on by the Mujahideen of Afghanistan and those who supported them, including the United States, Pakistan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, European Union, etc., Japan, China, too. During that unstable period, you know, it was easy to have the growth of this opium crop, you know, expand tremendously. And we didn't particularly discourage it because we understood that those who were fighting the Soviets were using the revenue to get weapons and things of this nature. And so it's very important for us to help try to wean the Afghans away from that. They're not culturally disposed, really, to that kind of thing, but they are dependent upon survival. We know from our failure of trying to wipe out the drugs and coming to the U.S. from South America that, you know, wiping out Afghanistan's opium production is not something that is going to be easy. We can't do it. There is no crop that can replace the opium poppy. But there are economies that can. We're members of a family, maybe five working on a plot with raising opium poppy. If they're encouraged to grow an alternate crop or maybe continue what they're doing, but also become plumbers or, you know, carpenters or mechanics or something like this, so families aren't so dependent upon that one crop. And we haven't really addressed it effectively in that way. And that's made it more problematic to you know, stem the rise of the production. And if we wipe it out just by, you know, crop dusting or something of that nature, we also are creating a problem that's even bigger because then the families have no way to survive and people then quickly are joining militias that are attached to the Al-Qaeda narrative, et cetera, because they have the money to pay them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very complicated thing, and I think that, you know, question is a very pertinent one. I want to quickly say that, no, I did not have an additional kind of task when I was a Peace Corps volunteer or a Fulbright, or they had a Fulbright there. And you know, I have to admit that even my own sister asked me that. So, you know.
Really?
Of course, you know. So, and it's something, of course, that the Soviets believed had to be true because when I was, I think you know, I was involved in the back channel negotiations to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. And I think they believed that I, of course, was a part of America's intelligence network because in their society, that would have definitely been the case. But it was not. And so I don't know that I ever convinced my sister, and I don't know if I'm convincing the caller either, but that's just it's up to him. I can't remember all of the other different dishes that were placed on the table by him, but I do remember one thing, and that is, you know, this whole thing about our being there, our presence, whether it's, a good thing after all these years. The thing to remember is this, that if we want to live an isolated life, if our nation we feel should go through an isolated period, well, we can pull away from all these things. But as we learned yesterday in France, the world is not going to be peaceful by ignoring things. And these kinds of terrorist attacks, you know, are going to occur. And I think that's our major struggle. You know, I think I sent in a message to you, Kathleen, that I kind of bridle at this reference that Afghanistan is America's longest war. It is not. The longest war was the Cold War. That was almost 50 years. Afghanistan is a battlefront, a battleground for this war against terrorists, and that could be a very long war as well. And if we don't address that, we're not going to be free to go and market and work with developing economies, our own economies, educational exchanges, tourism, etc. We'll be very intimidated against those kinds of things. A globalized world, a world in which people move freely about from country to country with opportunities between countries, requires attention and focus on our interests and defending those interests.
Thank you very much, Jason, for the call. And I understand that fully. My question to you is this. The president has said we will continue with money and with the troops we're leaving behind, training, advising, assisting Afghan security forces. We also have these tremendously expensive, in terms of air power, the cost of the planes and the cost of the troops trying to fight ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. I mean, we're spending, some estimates are well over $1.5 trillion a year fighting all of this. And in those other wars, you wonder what kind of success we're seeing, if any, in the, what we're doing in Afghanistan. It is, I think, legitimate to ask the question, well, we've been there 13 years. Isn't that enough?
Well, I think we need to understand that everywhere in the world, we're going to have a footprint in some way or another. Why ask that question after 13 years in Afghanistan? What about the Cold War? We're still with major bases in Germany and England and in Italy and Spain, in Europe and in Korea and in Japan. I mean, this is, you know, more than 60 years thereafter. And this is one of the ways which we have, I think, decided our interests globally can be best protected. And so we need to find a way in which we can do the same kind of thing effectively in Afghanistan. It may look different than that which we have done elsewhere. Also, you know, the whole makeup of our defense structure, I think, is undergoing reexamination. We need to do that so we can be more effective in the way we do protect ourselves. And this is a part of it. And I think, you know, 3 years ago it was announced we were going to pull out by this and such a date. There would be nobody here, et cetera, et cetera. The numbers have changed. We adjust to these. We're going to continue to adjust. And so I don't see any numbers right now, Kathleen, as being finite in an American policy in Afghanistan. And with the challenges that are coming about in places like northern Nigeria with Boko Haram, with the various different al-Qaeda-related groups in Syria, there are at least four, including ISIS and the Nusra Front and two others. They're all intent upon setting up a world that is hostile to our global objectives. And we've got to decide whether or not we're willing to make the commitment to a presence in those parts of the world, or we're going to pull back and become the United States of the isolationist period of the 1920s that eventually, of course, led to World War II.
More phone calls in a moment. Thomas Goodyear is our guest this hour. He's joined us from time to time over the past several years, actually. Dean of International Studies and Programs, Senior Officer for Global Engagement, and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. We're talking about the announcement that our official involvement in Afghanistan is over. And that was announced in December of last year. But we have many troops remaining there. The task that remains, the danger that country poses now, what's happened to the Taliban. Our guest has also done recently a great deal of writing and speaking on ISIS and other al-Qaeda-related franchises. And because we're talking to him the day after a horrible terrorism attack in Paris, which we did not anticipate, of course, would happen, we're talking to him about that as well. Here's how you join us. We have a few minutes left for your calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. We're on Facebook as well. Leave your comments there. We always like to read them. The Kathleen Dunn Show and Twitter at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kenneth in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. The problem, seems to me, is that for them, religion is government, and government is religion, and never the twain shall meet as far as a Western democracy, et cetera. And, you know, nothing really changes. They put up a Potemkin village that we have paid for, but they just want to be left alone. I mean, we would not tolerate for a minute what goes on in Saudi Arabia, but we want their oil, and we don't, you know, we don't attack the Saudis in their capitals or whatever, but we buy billions of barrels of oil from them, and they do their thing, and we use their oil. Just put a great big wall around the countries and that we don't need, and leave them alone.
Professor Goodyear.
Well, again, another complicated question. First of all, the price of oil right now has dropped down to $50 a barrel, so we are less dependent, but that's not going to be a permanent condition. And if we put up walls around these countries, it's not just Saudi Arabia, but also Nigeria and Venezuela and other oil producers. And didn't deal with them, we wouldn't be able to have these commercial as well as political diplomatic relationships. And they're very important. We consider right now Saudi Arabia to be an ally. We have many thousands of them paying lots of money to study at our universities around the United States because the Saudis have decided that they want their students to have an education in the Western world so that they can bring these kinds of modern, this modern thinking and development back incrementally to their society. We'll see where that will go. It's a major challenge. The other thing about the religion and the society or the politics not meeting, it's important to remember that when our person who raised the question here used the term they, to whom is he referring? They is a very, very totally inclusive word. And the Afghans, for example, that I know, 90% of them, although all of them may be Muslim, just like large numbers of us may be Christians or Jews in the United States, they all think differently in terms of their religion. And most of the educated and the young people of Afghanistan whom I know, and we know many, you mentioned, Kathleen, that I lived there those 10 years, but we continue to be very active going back and forth to Afghanistan,
yes,
involved in educational programs. They want the same basic kinds of things that we want in our lives, and they're not extreme in their religious beliefs. They are not supportive in any way of elements like the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. In fact, they fear them more than do we because they have more of a deleterious impact on their lives than they have on our own. So it's not correct or fair to characterize people from a particular part of the world as they, because there are many elements in any society, and they're all very different, and most of them in every country are hoping for them and their children the same kinds of opportunities and stability that we seek for our own children.
Thank you, Kenneth, for the call. Leslie in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi. I just came in on this conversation, and I actually, just listening to what he just said, Thomas, I agree with you. I've been going back and forth from Afghanistan and Jordan for the past 5 years, primarily doing humanitarian work and working with the local farmers up in the Panjir Valley and Tucker and Somali Plains, which you probably know where those areas are. And my understanding, and part of this has to do with the history of Afghanistan, which I didn't know until I got there, that Afghanistan was considered one of the biggest breadbaskets of Central Asia, and that they exported all of their dried fruit and their grapes and their pomegranate and their melons. They were famous for it. This was a very rich agricultural country before the Russians came in and started burning down, you know, thousands of acres, and then the Taliban. And this is something that most Americans wouldn't know unless you actually studied the history of that area. And you talked about, and I agree with you, we tend to look at things on a short-term basis. It's our Western culture. And it is so important to try to start to look at this from a different paradigm, and that is long-term relationships and not creating these vacuums over and over again that create these, you know, insurgent groups that come into the area. And we're working with local economies, creating local economies with the farmers so that they at least have enough to eat and have enough diet and nutrition, because of the problem with malnutrition over there as well. So even starting on that small a scale does make a big difference when you're talking about poppy fields. And lastly, I want to say, I went over to the Middle East, and this is an emotional thing, because I had so much hatred because of what happened in 9/11. And I've lived all over the world. I didn't grow up in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. I grew up in Boston. And I've been all over the world, and I decided that I wanted to go to the Middle East because I really wanted to see what the people were about. And when you talk about they, I absolutely agree with you that a good, easily 90% of the people there, whether they're men or women, didn't matter what the age group was, were very, they're family-oriented. They're very, very family-oriented. They're just trying to get by. They want a better life for themselves. They actually really respect Americans. They know a lot more about us than we know about them. And it's a shame, in one sense, that a small group of terrorists has taken over the identity of these wonderful people.
Thomas, your response?
Hello?
Go ahead, Thomas.
Yeah, right. I just think that what that caller did was give several exclamation points to the point that I was trying to make earlier, and I did it very, very articulately, and I appreciate that. I think she is a person who has gone by her own actions and experience to witness the kinds of things that I have as well, and I certainly appreciate the fact that we're in agreement, and I, of course, think she's right.
Thank you, Leslie, for the call. One final message, Paul, on email. How European efforts to track down and root out terrorists differ from American approaches, particularly in the era of the European Union?
Well, I think that it hasn't been as steadfast, but I think it's becoming more steadfast as the European countries, in particular now, Great Britain, France, and a couple others, which have large numbers of people from around the world who have been born in their countries and then have gone to join up with these various franchises, which we've been talking about. They've come to understand that these kinds of things are threatening their societies as well. I don't mean to imply that they were not doing anything. They were, but they weren't as steadfast, and I think this is helping them to focus more on the need for collaborative efforts between the NATO nations and others in Europe that want to safeguard the capacity of their citizens and others as well to be able to be participants in a society where globalization is the key for future growth and the kind of life that the last caller was describing the people in the Middle East also want for their families.
A pleasure to talk with you again, Thomas Goodyear. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Kathleen. Let's do a little more often.
All right. Thomas Goodyear, Dean of International Studies and Programs. He's at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and he's director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies. It's a country that has been of deep interest to him ever since he was a Peace Corps volunteer there back in 1965. He speaks so many languages. He has testified before the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the U.S. House Committee on International Relations, on Afghanistan and U.S.-Pakistani relations, and done a lot of humanitarian work in the country as well. Thanks to Scotty Myers and K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in snowy downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up from NPR and Babies, Hour 2.